What is going on? It is August 3rd, 2016. The MMA Podcast 180 is always a ton to break down. This past Saturday, we had UFC 201, Robbie Lawler versus Tyron Woodley. And we have a new UFC welterweight champ to talk about. Of course, this weekend, UFC Fight Night, Yair versus Caceres. We also haven't done an interview in a while, but on this episode, we have Pro MMA Radio's Larry Pepe on to talk PEDs, USADA, the new welterweight champ, and Woodley. Nick Diaz coming off that suspension saying he wants a big money fight. A ton to break down. Let's do it.
Listening to the MMA Podcast.
That's right, Lenny Hart. It is the MMA Podcast. If you do like the show, you can always go and visit themmapodcast.com. Haven't updated it with news in a while. Gonna try and get back on that this fall. But the tabs at the top always work to visit us at SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, all that stuff. My co-host tonight, I guess his call must have dropped, and he called me right there at the end of the intro music. It's P Money. He's on Twitter at Sweet Pappy Jones. What's going on, Pat?
Oh, Jake, it's a beautiful Wednesday night here in SoCal. We are just loving the action we had at UFC 201. Looking very much forward to this weekend's UFC action. Not a whole lot in the way of news, Jake, but definitely some interesting points we're going to get to touch on. And, definitely looking forward to breaking it down with you this Wednesday night.
Yeah, you know, we're a little bit devoid of news this week, but it helps. We have that that interview with Larry Pepe from Pro MMA Radio. Go and check his show out at ProMMAradio.com. A couple things to talk about, just news and notes. You know, it's not really officially news that Nick Diaz has come off his suspension, but he's made a couple ESPN visits, so we'll talk about that, talk about whether he's up next in line to face the new welterweight champion that was crowned at UFC 201. I guess we'll go there first. Actually, I was about to say, if you're listening live, you can call the number, but this is one of the rare shows that we're not doing live. This Skype rig has been acting up. We're going to figure that out instead of having jumbled up calls on the air, but we should be back doing it live either next week or the week after. Like I said, subscribe to the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, and YouTube, all for free.
Free 99.
The low, low. UFC 201, Tyron Woodley, the star of the night, but as always, we'll save that for last. Let's talk about the prelims. Some really impressive performances. Wilson Hayes, who is going to fight Demetrius Johnson on the co-main event, instead had to fight on the Fox Sports 2 prelims. Looked real good, defeating Hector Sandoval. Didn't get his title shot. Not sure if he'll get a title shot next. I'm hearing a lot of rumors about him fighting Ian McCall, who got screwed out of a fight against Justin Scoggins because he didn't make weight. Who else looked good? Damian Brown on that intro UFC Fight Pass card. Jorge Masvidal looked good. Probably the best performance on the prelims, Nikita Krylov with that head kick KO over Ed Herman. He's come a long way since that boring fight a few years ago when he made his debut against Soa Pulele. He's on a 5-fight win streak now. He moved down to 205, lost to OSP. Hasn't lost since, so he should get a decent opponent next. What stood out on the prelims to you, bud?
Well, you know what? There's definitely some good prelim action for UFC 201. This is definitely one of those cards where you look at it on paper. At least, I don't know what you think, Jake, but for me, it was one of those ones. You look at it on paper, not the most overwhelming, kind of hard to get excited for the card, but turned out to be one that delivered. Definitely some solid action there. As you mentioned, Damian Brown, he looked good with his first-round KO. Cesar Arzamendia, Wilson Hayes got a nice first-round submission, staying active, staying fresh, trying to legitimize a opportunity for a title shot there, albeit taking on opposition without a Wikipedia page. But anyways, he's beaten who's being put in front of him. Anthony Hamilton, my goodness, a heavyweight, looking real good against Damian Grabowski. He came in there and was just rocking him to death with these uppercuts. My goodness. Brutal KO there. Jorge Masvidal, I believe, is as you and I both called, over Ross Pearson, just doing his thing, man. Game Bread is a top-tier fighter at, you know, 170, 155. I know as of late in the UFC, he's just been at 170. I want to say his last four, maybe five fights, and he's been doing really well for himself, like what Jorge Masvidal has been doing lately. And yeah, Nikita Krylov, definitely. I know went with old Krylov over Ed Herman, but my goodness, I did not think it would be quite that definitive. Krylov with that head kick, that was just planted like, man, that looked like right on the back of the ear slash just right on the temple. Either way, I mean, that was a sweet, sweet, perfectly placed left head kick there. Put old Herman down. I just hope that Krylov passes his test because Ed Herman was popping off. I hope they're testing Krylov. Not that Krylov looks like a light heavyweight that's juicing. Definitely, at least to me, looks like he has more of a natural build. Of course, there has been instances where we've seen fighters with, you know, seemingly fairly natural builds, not super exaggerated, and they have come up hot for something. So hopefully old Krylov is able to remain clean there and able to hold on to that win bonus, because that was definitely one of the more impressive feats on the preliminary card for me.
And that is one nice thing about this day and age. You know, if someone's cheating, you'll probably eventually find out. It's not like back in the day where you kind of could sidestep these tests. The tests are right on nowadays. Let's do all the fights up to the co-main, which were Ryan Benoit with a split decision over Freddy Serrano. Eric Perez, unanimous decision over Francisco Rivera. That kind of played out like I thought it would. Rivera kind of punching himself out early, and Eric Perez taking charge the rest of the fight. Two of the judges saw it 30-26. And in the fight that we both got dead wrong, Jake Ellenberger defeating Matt Brown. Brown seemed to be on a tear, only losing to the elite of the elite. Jake Ellenberger was like 1-5 in his last six. His only win against a now retired Josh Koscheck. Brown, you know, was tearing folks up. Tim Means, Eric Silva, Mike Pyle. Yeah, he had a few losses too, but they came to Robbie Lawler, Johnny Hendricks, and Damian Maia, who all could have, you know, they're all arguably top five welterweights. Maybe not Johnny anymore, but at the time, he certainly was. So I just thought, man, stylistically, every little facet, you know, I'm giving this fight to Matt Brown. But Jake Ellenberger took advantage of a weakness we've seen Brown have in previous fights, which those liver kicks and liver shots, he can get folded up seemingly easier than a lot of other fighters if with a well-placed liver kick and or punch. And after I believe the first time Brown got hurt, it was because of a overhand right or an overhand left, and it wasn't a body blow. But the second time, the time where the fight ended up getting finished, Jake lands a kick, folds up Brown, follows it up with hammer fists, and I believe it was Mark Goddard reffing that fight who pulled Ellenberger off in a minute 46. So I was correct about the quick stoppage, just dead wrong about who the fight's victor was going to be, with Jake Ellenberger, big underdog, live dog, defeating the immortal one, Matt Brown.
Yeah, very live dog. Much liver than you and I certainly thought, Jake. That was definitely a fight that one of our consensus fights that we have some egg on our face for. But, hey, at least it was not as bad as our Hendricks over Thompson call. Not quite with such hyperbole and emphasis were we calling for Matt Brown over Jake Ellenberger. But we did make that call, and we were dead wrong. Yeah, old Jake came out storming with that big overhand right. I mean, I don't know. He must have known Matt Brown. He must have just drawn up a very good game plan. I mean, obviously he did. It just executed very well. He came out. Ellenberger's always had heavy hands. He's been one of the heavier handed guys in the division. And he put it on Brown quick and fast, dropped him. Almost had it with that big overhand right, like you were mentioning, Jake. And then it was that kick to the body. I mean, you could just see the wave of force almost just being sent through Matt Brown. This wasn't one of those body kicks where it was like, that was mostly toes. This was like shin to liver, and you could just see the ripple in his flesh of just the energy being transferred like a stone being skipped across a pond. You could just see that rippling, and he went down Ellenberger with the hammer fist from hell, just absolutely brutalized Matt Brown. Sick first round stoppage. Good to see Ellenberger looking like the Ellenberger that we had known for so many years, a real top contender at the 170-pound division. I mean, always had all the tools, solid wrestling, heavy hands, and had always been a resilient fighter. But, yeah, it was good to see him get a very good, a very impressive win after some low points in his career there. And then as far as Eric Perez and his defeat over Francisco Rivera, Ryan Benoit over Freddie Serrano, I thought those were both good fights. I love watching the bantamweights and the flyweights fight. Always super technical. You know, they go everywhere. The pace never slows. I want to say I was with you in the Eric Perez fight. I know I was a little torn with that, but El Goyito, he's a phenom. He's training out there with Greg Jackson's camp, doing big things. He's made a good run for himself in the UFC in spite of a little bit of inactivity. And yeah, Ryan Benoit, good prospect in the flyweight division, getting a split call there over the tough Freddie Serrano. So yeah, definitely some good action kicking off the main card.
And then we move to the co-main event, which I don't know. I don't want to sound cocky, but I gotta save a little face after that horrible Matt Brown call. You know, I said the fight's gonna come down to whether Carolina can keep Thug Rose in the clinch, and she was able to. I actually picked Thug Rose on the podcast, but during their walkouts, I changed my pick. Carolina looked, you know, she looked, you know, alert, focused, all there, and Rose looked like she was freaking out before the fight. You know, she's said she's had mental issues in fights before, and I mean, shoot, I'm not gonna stand here and try and sound like I'm dogging someone for having mental issues. I could not be a fighter to get in your underwear and step in front of millions of people and fight someone else in a cage. Something I would never have the guts to do. But, you know, it doesn't mean, I can't say someone seems to just be having mental issues. And you've seen it with a ton of fighters. Uriah Hall comes to mind. You know, the skills are there, the attributes are there, but there's just a mental obstacle the fighter just can't get over. I don't know. You know, I think Thug Rose is young and can definitely string a few wins and, you know, build up herself and be the champion eventually. But I thought in this fight, Kovalkovich, I've heard it said a bunch of times, but Carolina ends up getting the split decision win, 28-29. I scored it 29-28 to Kovalkovich, so I thought she was the rightful winner. And Rose, I think she lost two, was on a 3-fight win streak. Now has lost another, so she'll probably stay in the top 10 and get a top 10 opponent next. What did you and I guess this was a title eliminator fight, and it'll be an all Polish championship next. Joanna Champ taking on Carolina, probably in I would guess 4 or 5 months for the strawweight belt.
Ooh, and that is a fight I'm rather excited for. But before that, getting into Kovalkovich and Alma Yunus, that I mean, that was a solid fight. These ladies are great scrappers, definitely, definitely top talent in the UFC women's strawweight division. Nama Yunus and Kovalkovich definitely belong there in the top 10, maybe top 5 range for both of them. And you really did hit the nail right on the head, Jake. It was Kovalkovich getting that bread and butter going in the clinch. Nama Yunus was no slouch. I mean, it was a split decision. It was a close fight. Nama Yunus was definitely sneaking her shots in. She was landing some good lefts and rights, some good shots to the head, while Kovalkovich, she was really digging to the body with some savage knees. I mean, she was mixing up her striking fairly well herself. Definitely enough, I would say she earned the decision as well. Man, it was a dogfight. Nama Yunus is tough. She is the Thug Rose. She was not just going to be put away easily. But yeah, Nama Yunus Kovalkovich, I feel, earned that one. And man, she is a tough cookie herself there, Jake. My goodness, that clinch work is beautiful. And yeah, apparently sets up the next women's strawweight title fight. I don't know if Kovalkovich wants to go to the clinch with Yan Jacek, though. Does she, Jake? I mean, she's probably going to be eating some savage elbows. And, I mean, from distance, I mean, the distance game, I think we know who that goes to. That'll be joining camp. I mean, whew, that is a tough test for any women. An unenviable task for the women at the 115-pound division. And really, I mean, I dare say that right now, Yanni and AJ really looks like, well, her and Mighty Mouse just seem like the two. They are the two dominant champions. It's going to be a very tough battle for Kovalkovich. I mean, I'm pretty sure she can have height and reach deficiencies. And the acumen of Joanna, she has come very far as a mixed martial artist. She's definitely improved, it seems like. I mean, her and Gadea certainly seem to be 1A and 1B. Well, I should say number 1 and number 2. I mean, Joanna has now beaten her twice, technically. So, got to give credit where credit's due. Joanna, she is number 1. And the striking, her takedown defense, she's a super tough fighter, and really the combination of skills that she brings combined with her frame in the 150-pound division, I mean, she is going to be a tough champion for a long time, and very difficult for Carolina Kovalkovich or really any woman to unseat.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that fight as well, and do agree that Joanna is going to be going in there with rightfully big odds in her favor. Which brings us to the main event, which, man, a lot of people were picking the underdog in Woodley, and it was obvious why. You know, you look at Robbie's last 3 fights. A split decision against Johnny that I think neither of us think that Lawler won. A very close fight against Rory McDonald that Robbie was losing in the fifth round before he finished Rory. A fight against Carlos Condit at UFC 195 that I think most people think Carlos Condit won. Woodley just went in there and what, 2 minutes, 12 seconds, finishes the fight, which it really makes you think about the parity in the welterweight division, especially how fast guys climb and fall. I mean, you know, you have Johnny Hendricks barely in the top 10 after taking a couple L's to Wonderboy and Gastelum. You have Woodley, who just, I mean, it was just 2 years ago when Rory embarrassed him at UFC 174. Now Woodley's the champ, and Rory is probably going to Bellator. You know, you have Maya, who a lot of folks thought was old and done, and now is a top guy at welterweight. You have Wonderboy Thompson, who is probably the rightful number one challenger. I mean, you have got a ton going on at welterweight.
Yeah, there really is. There's a lot going on now, and man, it's a super exciting division. And what I find exciting, you know, it's always great to watch a good fight, a good performance, and it's always good to be so right in accurately predicting that performance. I'm sorry, Jake, I got to continue to toot our horns, because this is why the folks listen to the MMA podcast. We give you those good predictions, the good underdog bets. Goodness gracious, more often than not, I mean, go back, check our track record, check the credentials. This was just a fantastic fight. I know for me, one thing that really led me to picking Tyron Woodley, we all know MMA math is not perfect, and a lot of times it doesn't work, and styles just make fights. But, man, I was looking at that fight with Carlos Condit, both Woodley's and Robbie Lawler's, and just night and absolute day. And I said the speed, the athleticism with which Woodley was able to dispatch Carlos Condit. Yeah, it was like a TKO injury stoppage, but it was because Tyron Woodley beat Carlos Condit until his body broke down. That is what happened in that fight. This wasn't, you know, Anderson Silva breaking his leg, which I still give all credit to Weidman. I'm not going to take it away from him, but that's neither here nor there. Just what Woodley was able to do to Condit versus Lawler's fight with Condit, which, you know, I was certainly one of those ones that thought he did not win that fight. I thought, although it was a good fight, it was a war, it was a classic. Lawler had his moments. It was a great Robbie Lawler fight. He showed the heart, he showed the chin, the fight, the tenacity. It was all there. Except I don't feel he won, and somehow he was gifted the title once more. He was able to retain. And I just said, you know what? And that's the other thing, too. Robbie, he gets hit. He gets hit a lot. He's got a solid chin that stood up to everybody before, except for Nick Diaz. But Tyron, just too good, too fast. Just, you know, hey, styles make fights. And this was Tyron's night. And, man, he put it on Robbie Lawler quick and fierce. That was a savage shot that put him down, and then the follow up blows. Oh my goodness! You knew there was a new champion being crowned with that ground and pound that was coming down.
And one thing which I actually spoke to Larry Pepe about on the interview I'm going to play here in a second. Is this new trend of fighters asking for the money fight instead of asking for the guy who necessarily deserves the next shot? You know, you had Eddie Alvarez saying he wants a fight against Conor McGregor instead of Ferguson or Habib. You have, who else? Michael Bisping, who's taking a money fight against Dan Anderson instead of, you know, taking on the next guy in line, probably Jacare. A lot of examples of, you know, these fighters going after the big payday. What do you make of Woodley after the fight saying, nope, I want to fight Nick Diaz or maybe GSP, and I have no interest in fighting Wonderboy Thompson, which I'm looking up the clip on UFC tonight. It's actually a pretty funny clip, but Wonderboy straight up asks him on the post-fight show about a fight, and Woodley keeps it real and says, no, I'd rather take a money fight against Nick Diaz. I'm sorry.
Well, you know what? I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can read into that. For me personally, I don't think there's not a lot of MMA fighters in general, especially UFC fighters at that level, that are really scared to fight anyone, I believe. I think a lot of this is just that fighters are just really now really starting to leverage that star position. You know, there were a lot of these guys. You know, there were a lot of guys that would reach certain heights and just, you know, would not renegotiate or just would not have any leverage for negotiation. But certainly once you get that championship belt, that's got to help things a little bit. So I certainly can't fault Tyron. And especially when you just look at how often belts have been changing hands these days in the UFC, hey, if you get that championship belt around your waist, use that leverage. Try and get that money fight. I'm not going to blame you. I know these fighters, the majority of them, they're making peanuts the whole time of their career. You know, maybe Tyron Woodley did decent for himself, you know, in the Strikeforce days. I mean, they had the Showtime contracts, things like that. So, you know, who knows? Maybe he's been getting some money. But a lot of these fighters, I mean, man, they're seeing 8-8s, 10-10s. You know, 20s and 20s for a while. I mean, some of these guys, Mighty Mouse was champion making, I want to say, 45-45. So, yeah, you got to get that money fight. And really, I just think the general underpayment of the fighters and them just kind of realizing, hey, this is, you know, this is a marketable position that I'm in. I need to seize this opportunity. I think these all combined for fighters coming out and saying, hey, I want the money fight as opposed to the most deserving fighter, quote unquote.
I couldn't disagree with you anymore. But to hear what my argument is, you're going to have to keep listening when we have Larry Pepe on in a little bit. And I ask him, I think myself and Larry have a different take on that. Here is that back and forth between Stephen Thompson and Woodley after the fight.
We talked several months back. I believe it was at one of the shows, one of the fights. And I could tell it in your eyes that, man, something different about you, man. I mean, even being out for that long, I could tell that you were going to go out there and give it your all. So congratulations. That said, that was a first round. That was a first round finish. And I know you're uninjured, but what are the chances that we get it on in November, my friend?
Well, this is what I think. You know, I think that you say you want to fight Robbie Lawler, and you get an opportunity to fight Robbie Lawler, because who I want to fight now is, I think Nick Diaz comes off suspension in 2 days. He's a money fight. I've been in this game. I'm an OG. I've been here for a while. I want to make the big dough. So if he wants to fight August with his brother, Nate Diaz, I think me and him can show down at the event. I'm uninjured. August, I'm ready to go, 202. Let's make the money. I think he's deserved it. I think he's put enough butts in the seat. He deserved to make that payday, so let's go get it.
This is all I'm saying. What if the St. Louis Rams beat the Dallas Cowboys in the NFC Championship to go and play the Denver Broncos, and the Broncos go, you know what, nah, we want to play the Cowboys in the Super Bowl because that's going to make more money because they got more fans, more folks are going to watch. Like, there is got to be a point where you have to honor the accomplishments and achievements of fighters. And here, this is Diaz on MMA Live with Brett Okamoto. I'm only going to play a minute of it, but this is Diaz a couple days ago on ESPN talking about his recently ended suspension.
So right now, sitting here today, August 1st, 2016. What are the big fights out there for Nick Diaz?
We're going to have to see. That's what I said. We're going to have to sit down and have a look at what the fans want to see and who these guys, you know, they, like I said, I'm on top right now. I'm on the top of this game. You know, there ain't no giving me a shot. I'm giving somebody a shot. if anybody's getting a shot, if somebody's getting a shot against me, because I'm the guy to beat. Because like I said, I don't need nothing. I'm fine the way I am.
Potentially that guy.
We'll see if how he does. We'll see how he does. He has some fights to do. He just gets the title now, and then, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm over here just sitting back. Like, I don't need a fight. There's no reason for me to come and fight for fun. I don't do that. That's not what I do. I don't like to hurt people for fun, and I don't have any. I like Tyrone Woodley, and I like Robbie Lawler. So can we talk about a reason behind why I should be out to get somebody?
If the UFC came to you right now with a fight.
In what parallel fucking bizarre backwards universe do we live in that Nick Diaz, who has not won a fight since 2011, and that fight was against a lightweight named BJ Penn. So really the last fight he won at welterweight against someone his own size was Paul Daly back in Strikeforce in 2011. Since then, he beat Penn, lost to Condit, lost to GSP, lost to Anderson Silva, a fight that was turned over to be a no contest after Silva tested positive for androstenedione. In steroids, Nick obviously tested positive for marijuana and was suspended for 18 months. In what parallel universe is that Nick Diaz, who hasn't won since in almost 5 years, saying, Woodley could fight a few fights. I don't know if he's earned a fight against me yet. We'll see what happens with Woodley. Woodley being the active champion who just won a title fight against Robbie Lawler, who had defended it two or three times. What kind of backwards bizarro universe is this, P-Money?
Oh, Jake, this is kind of universe I love to live in. It's so unpredictable, and it makes so little sense. But you know what? I really feel like that clip with Tyrone Woodley, Jake, even Tyrone himself, kind of confirmed my point, and Nick Diaz as well. You know, Tyrone said, "I'm an OG in this game. I want the money fight." Because even being an OG in this game, and I think the difference with the NFL and the players have a revenue sharing program. They have a union. The NFL is making billions of dollars, and these players are seeing a great majority of it. The UFC, conversely, was just sold for billions of dollars, and I'm sure generated, I would say, who knows, 8-9 figures of profit per year. One can only really speculate. UFC kept their books tight, but
I think I think the rough numbers in like the big four sports, the athletes make roughly half. It's, you know, in hockey, basketball, baseball, and football, it's somewhere between 45 and 55 for all those sports. We're in the UFC.
Exactly.
I think I forget who it was, but someone with Bloody Elbow maybe did a deep expose on it, and I think the number the UFC was estimated to be giving its fighters was somewhere between 15% and 20%, a third of what the numbers are for, you know, your main big four sports.
Yeah, exactly. So this is why you see the lack of meritocracy, or fighters who say, oh, I don't want the most deserving fighter necessarily. I want the guy who's going to get me the most money, because they've been fighting to get that money for a long time, and they have not gotten it. A lot of these guys, I mean, hey, here's Tyrone right here. I'm an OG in this game. I want the money. I finally want a chance to make some money. I've been getting my brains beaten in for 10 years now. I'd like a chance to finally make some money that makes this career worth it. Really, I do think that is the majority of what this is. Could there be a little bit of, you know, who knows, maybe them wanting an easier fight to have an opportunity to retain their championship and have multiple championship fights? Certainly, I would not argue that would be a valid point, and I could certainly see where, from a psychological perspective, that is a standpoint that makes a lot of sense. I just think, though, that due to the nature of the UFC and the nature of mixed martial arts and the general lack of money. I really do think it's just that, you know, these guys, especially nowadays, they know this is their big shot. You know, they've seen and heard a lot of people talking about this Conor McGregor money. UFC fighters hearing, oh, seven, eight figures. I'd like to make 7 to 8 figures for a payday, $5 million for one fight. I haven't made $1 million in my entire career. So that's a very appealing angle, and I feel like that's why it's getting to be a little more prevalent these days, just because fighters realize it's possible now in some cases.
Yeah, and you know, that makes a lot of sense as to why, but you know, why you see fighters doing this, but I still think that, you know, as much as I'd like to see Woodley, you know, make his big checks, you know, we can't just kind of give every new champion a money fight. Just, oh, you've been in the game, here's a money fight, and here's a money fight. You know, it's got to be more based around ratings, which, I mean, you know, we have these UFC rankings, and it's hilarious because when they came out, even Dana said, yeah, pardon me, I'm not going to use these at all to decide where to make title fights. So it's transparently not a meritocracy, but I would like to see it shift back to becoming more of one. One more bit of news before we get to this interview and then break down the Salt Lake City card that's going to be going down this Saturday. A lot of changes to rules, pretty much all of which I am a fan of. They have more specific scoring criteria. Here, I'm just going to read it straight from the page. The proposed new criteria will have judges evaluate the damage, dominance, and duration of a round. If a round contains two of those three characteristics, a 10-8 must be considered. If it has all three, then a 10-8 or even a 10-7 must be the score. A 10-7 score calls for overwhelming dominance and significant damage with a referee stoppage warranted. They also made the octagon control and aggression scoring criteria more tiebreakers instead of a you know, main criteria of what to break down. They also redefined what a grounded fighter was, so no more fighters putting one hand down and kind of playing the one hand rule as far as being grounded and then not being grounded. So, you know, you can kind of goad your opponent into taking an illegal kick and getting a disqualification. I think my favorite one of the entire rule changes were now it is a foul to throw your arm out or your hand out toward your opponent's face with your fingers pointing toward the face. You've either got to make a closed fist or have your fingers point straight up, doing that little distance check thing to where you could poke an eye is now a foul, even if you don't touch him, which we can go ahead and call that the John Jones rule. And it's a rule I think is great that they're putting in. What do you think about the all of these new rule changes that will, I think, take effect January 1st of 2017?
Oh, I'm loving these rule changes myself, personally. As far as the specific judging criteria, I thought that was kind of how it was supposed to be anyways, as far as judging by significant striking and significant grappling first. I mean, if you're winning any of those, but anyways, I just, the more specific these rules get, I think that can only help. And them specifically outlining, okay, this is what a 10-8 or 10-7 round looks like, and this is how they need to be judged. I mean, hey, the more specific and the more information and more scenarios you can compare it to, that's just going to be better. As far as the John Jones rule, I think it's fantastic. There is absolutely no reason for a fighter to have their fingers out to quote unquote gauge for distance. You don't strike someone with the tips of your fingers, so you're getting an inaccurate gauge of distance anyways. it's called pumping the jab. You know, try pumping the jab. And I think we're going to have to see a lot more fighters doing that instead of, you know, or going for the more open palm strike style kind of feeling out a distance. Great rule there, as well as the further definition of a grounded opponent. I think it is excellent. No more the one hand. I believe, what is it? You have to have 4 points of contact now. Like all limbs need to be down. If I believe that is how the rule is reading these days, you have to have like two knees. You have to have 4 points of contact, if I'm not mistaken. And hey, that's great for me. No more of you know, fighters stalling against the cage with one hand down. You can now eat a knee to the face in that position. It is excellent. It will force fighters to work for better positions, less stalling against the cage, I believe, anyways. Just my amateur analysis. But, yeah, I think there should be some solid definitions and enhancements to the rules.
And, you know, you have really great refs like John McCarthy, Herb Dean, Mark Goddard, that, you know, I can't wait until we see the first person get called for a foul trying to do that bullshit. But we have this interview I recorded Monday, actually, with Pro MMA Radio's Larry Pepe. We'll go ahead and get to it now, clip it in. One of the, you know, we really haven't done an interview in a while, so, it's automatically one of my favorite recent interviews, but one of my, favorite interviews we've really done in a while. This was a good one. We, talked a little bit of, John Jones, Brock Lesnar, little Chad Mendez, his pop for a banned substance. Talked about the Woodley asking for the money fight thing. A lot of stuff. Covered a lot of bases. Was a real mensch. Follow him on Twitter at Larry Pepe. And here it is, my chat with Pro MMA Radio's Larry Pepe. Today's guest is a journalist and himself the host of Pro MMA Radio, Larry Pepe. Thanks for coming on the show. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, Jake. Pleasure to be on.
Cool. Yeah, I've said it before, but I urge people to go out. I urge people to go out and download episode 10 and 36 of the unfortunately now defunct Filthy FRB show, where Front Row Brian, Tom Lawler, and Larry went deep into breaking down various doping violations, USADA, Anderson Silva, IV bans, all that fun stuff. And that's actually where I wanted to start this evening. How shocked were you 72 hours out from UFC 200 when the world found out that John Jones was pulled from the card, not because of a hit and run or alcohol related or drug related, but a PED related, a quote, potential USADA violation? How shocked were you when that news was handed down?
Yeah, you know, Jake, I was pretty shocked. I mean, in this day and age, it's hard to be shocked by anything after Anderson Silva. Like, for me, Anderson Silva failing his drug test was probably the turning point where I said, if Anderson can fail, Anderson, who looks like a stick figure, whose body hasn't changed over time in any significant way, who I thought was always kind of the example of technique trumps all. You know, technique trumps strength. It trumps that he fights guys who are twice his size, like Chael Sonnen and Chris Weidman. He's just so elite, so skilled at what he does, that he was that example for me. And when I woke up that morning and saw that he failed, I was like, okay, anybody can fail. So John failing in that respect was not as shocking for me as Anderson, but what did make it shocking was the timing, because you just sit there and you say to yourself, how can USADA be this incompetent that they can be doing drug tests that are putting the promotion in a position that days before the biggest event in UFC history, as it was billed, you're pulling the main event fighter off the card. And that, to me, was probably the more shocking part. John failing, surprising, sure, but in this day and age, I'm not sure how we can be too shocked by anybody failing, but the timing was really the more shocking aspect to me. Of course, not as shocking as when Brock Lesnar's test result from June 28th came back 17 days later, but I'm going to guess you're going to ask me about that at some point before we get done.
Yeah, you know, we may as well move to that question now. I think it was episode 413, and you were going deep into that test taking 17 days. You also brought up the old, I guess it's now almost forgotten story about the Belfort Jones fight, where the UFC may have known about a failed test and kind of kept it close to the hip. I'll let you dive deep into it, but tell us about the facet of this Lesnar story that you think the media might be conveniently skirting around.
Yeah, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, timing on some of these tests is concerning, and none more concerning than Brock's, because when you look at his June 28th test, it didn't come back until 5 days after, or 6 days after, the pay-per-view was in the books and the money was in the bank. And that's troubling to me. It should be troubling to every fighter, as it is obviously very troubling to Mark Hunt. It should be troubling to every media member, and it's clear that it's not. And the reason it's troubling is because simple math dictates that it doesn't make a lot of sense that a pre-fight test, that you know, if you're USADA and you are sending your inspector to do that collection, you know that this individual is stepping in the cage in 11 days. It's impossible to think that they could be that incompetent, which apparently they were, to not expedite that test. Now, to give USADA one benefit of the doubt, if you look historically at tests that are done at WADA-approved labs. There's only two WADA-approved labs in the United States. One is the Smertl Lab in Salt Lake City. The other one is at UCLA. Customarily, blood test results take 2 to 3 days. Urine results take 6 to 9. So if you were USADA and you did not believe in, I don't know, doing things in a way that would ensure that you would get the results back, like expedite them, which is inexcusable. It is inexcusable, especially when you're not footing the bill, to not expedite every single drug test that is done within 3 to 4 weeks of an event of a fighter who's fighting. Because what is the point, really, of doing the test if it's not for sure going to come back before that person actually fights? It's not just to catch them afterwards. The idea is to protect the health and safety of the other fighter and the fairness of competition. You're not doing that if you do tests and don't get them back before they actually fight. Unless you're just doing a test like it's an extra test that you're doing 2 or 3 days before the event, you know it's not going to come back. But maybe you think that fighter is trying to game the system because they don't think they're going to be tested anymore. But this wasn't that. This was 11 days out. If the normal test is 6 to 9 days, and we don't even have to go historically, how about we look at Brock's fight night test, which was on the 9th, came back on the 19th. 10 days. If you use that exact same 10-day measure, then they would have gotten Brock's failed June 28th test the day before UFC 200, which would have been a disaster. The idea that no one is raising or asking, well, wait a second, his fight night test, which has no urgency whatsoever, because you're not getting that back no matter what you do before he fights, and you know that. So there's no urgency to that test. The test with no urgency gets back in 10 days, which is mysteriously very close to the 6 to 9 day history that I found. to these types of tests. But the same test on the same guy pre-fight, which obviously has a sense of urgency, takes 17, and nobody's going to talk about that. Nobody's going to talk about that if there's one guy that kind of, from a stereotypical standpoint, personifies what you would be afraid of a 275-pound uber-athletic beast being on stuff fighting another person, if that's not going to raise people's consciousness, not only in the MMA media, but the mainstream sports media that was so concerned about a reporter's credential, but they're not concerned that Brock Lesnar, at 275 pounds, as strong and as athletic as he is, was able to get in a cage and beat another dude up when he had a dirty sample submitted 11 days prior. It's amazing to me that it is not getting a ton more of attention. And I've seen it said that it would be reckless to accuse them of having results ahead of time. It's not about accusing. It's about raising the question. How is the question not being asked? No one's saying that they knew for sure, but how you can look at these time frames as any media, any credible media, and not say, how in the world did this happen? And how can we make sure, how can we put enough pressure on the powers that be that medias are supposed to hold accountable? How can we make sure this doesn't happen again? Well, the way to make sure it doesn't happen again is to pressure them and embarrass them, because that's the only way things get done sometimes, into expediting every test that's done within 3 to 4 weeks of a fight. But that's not happening. That's not happening, and I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's unfair to raise the question when the UFC has done it in the past, done it within the last few years when we had the deal with Jones and Belfort. I mean, I guess if I'm USADA, is there any reason to speak up and say, hey, you know, we gave these tests back to UFC on X date? I don't know if, you know, there's any Freedom of Information Act there or anything, but I mean, if you are running the UFC and you're planning on selling the damn company within 24 hours, and you've gotten away with it before, and you're selling this UFC 200 card that's supposed to be the biggest card in the history of not just the UFC, but of the sport, and you're selling it around Brock Lesnar, and you find out a week before the fight that, oh, he tested hot. I mean, I think any rational owner would look at, you know, the test and go, well, you know, we're rolling the dice huge, but we've done it before, we've gotten away with it before, you know, we're, you know, like I laid the rest of that out. It's a very interesting question you're raising there.
Well, and I think this too, Jake. Like, you know, they wouldn't have had the result a week before. They probably would have gotten it within days if you look at the prior time frames, which would have put them in a position to potentially, if they got it, and I don't know, but again, you can't call yourself a journalist and not raise the question, for God's sakes, when the guy's own fight night test comes back in a time frame that would have mandated him being pulled from the card if his pre-fight test was done in the same time frame. So, you know, when you look at the timing, if it was 9 or 10 days, they literally would have gotten the result the day before or 2 days before the card, which would have been the day after they'd pulled Jones. So obviously it would have created massive issues. Did it happen? Who knows? But here's the thing. We know there's only two possibilities. Either USADA was straight up incompetent and didn't expedite his test, which is pretty clear at this point because it took 17 days, And why wouldn't you expedite them? I mean, common sense says the only people who wouldn't expedite them is, I don't know, maybe if you didn't want to know. Or you got the result. So either way, it's not a good look. And it's not just the UFC that has a history. USADA has a history. They governed the Eric Morales fight against Danny Garcia before they ever came on with the UFC. Eric Morales failed two drug tests, A and B samples. That's four dirty samples within 2 weeks of the fight. And Eric Morales fought. USADA apparently walked in on Floyd Mayweather before the Manny Pacquiao fight, after the weigh-in, and he either was getting or had just gotten an IV. That's a doping violation. He still fought, and they issued a, quote, retroactive therapeutic use exemption 18 days after the fight. So when you have two entities that historically have done things that are certainly don't pass a smell test, to not raise the question, to me, is reckless. Not raising the question, not raising it, is reckless.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. I want to get back to the John Jones test. When the UFC allowed, or they chose to stop allowing those therapeutic use exemptions, you were saying that the testers need to start screening for Clomid, which was one of the estrogen blockers, I believe, Chael tested for back in the day when I saw a tweet recently. He said he hit the high score with six. He tested positive for six things at once. It was one of the two things John tested for. Most of our listeners, and frankly myself included, aren't experts when it comes to this stuff. What purpose does Clomid serve to an elite athlete like Jones, and why did you advocate back then that we needed to start testing for it?
Great question. So the reason I advocated for it back then and warned about it before Chael failed was because once they got rid of the therapeutic use exemptions for testosterone, which I was never a fan of, I thought they were being given out too often, too easy to get, and it was basically a hall pass for doping. So I was glad that it went away. The issue, and the reason I raised Clomiphene or Clomid as something to watch out for, is because when an athlete or anybody takes synthetic testosterone, so we're talking about injectable testosterone or testosterone cream, you are taking an artificial form of testosterone and putting it in the body. The body says, oh, wait a second, I already have testosterone. I don't need to keep producing my own. So we have to distinguish. You naturally have testosterone in your body, and then you have this synthetic source of testosterone coming in. So your natural production goes down the longer you're on a synthetic testosterone and the more you're on. So the higher the dosage, the longer the duration, the lower your testosterone levels go. The problem with that is that when you come off the testosterone, the synthetic version, your body doesn't just go back on like a light switch. It doesn't say, oh, no more testosterone, let's just ramp it up and put it into the bloodstream. It takes time. And what Clomid and other estrogen blockers will do is they will, in essence, turbocharge that process. They'll speed up that process, and they'll make the body produce more of its own testosterone quicker than it would if it were doing it on its own. So when you pull testosterone out of the mix, when you have these athletes who are getting these hall passes to use testosterone, it's foreseeable that you're going to see estrogen blockers more prominent in their test results, especially if you're looking for them. And at the time, USADA wasn't doing that testing. The commissions were. And sometimes the commissions weren't that sophisticated in terms of what they should be looking for. And that's why I brought that up at that time. As far as why an athlete like John Jones might be on it, Brock Lesnar, ironically, we hear, failed for the same thing. There's multiple reports of that. So they both failed for clomiphene, if you believe those reports about Brock, because that hasn't been officially confirmed yet. There's really only three scenarios where an athlete would take Clomid or clomiphene. One is what I just described, coming off of a cycle and wanting to kick your natural testosterone production up quicker. You would take a Clomid or a clomiphene. So that's one. The second is during a cycle. A lot of times when athletes take stronger drugs, different testosterones, anadrols, things like that, there's something that takes place in some athletes called aromatization. It basically, there's more water retention. You've heard the phrase gynecomastia, which is in slang referred to as bitch tits, where it looks like a male will have like a little breast tissue around the nipple because of that retention, but it doesn't go away when they come off the drug. So if an athlete is particularly sensitive to the negative side effects of elevated estrogen, which do take place a lot of times when an athlete takes testosterone, they will go on the estrogen blocker to keep the estrogen down while the testosterone, the synthetic testosterone, is in their system. So one scenario is after a cycle, post-cycle therapy. The scenario I just outlined would be during a cycle. Both of these options involve using other drugs beyond an estrogen blocker. The only scenario where you would use only an estrogen blocker that I know of is if you were attempting to boost natural testosterone levels, but it wasn't because you were coming off a cycle. It was just because perhaps your testosterone levels were low, and rather than take injectable or synthetic testosterone, you're trying to boost your natural levels. I will tell you that that is the rarest of the three. The first two scenarios I outlined are very common. The third scenario, because it is known to be inefficient in comparison to just taking testosterone, is not used that often. But it is the one scenario where Jones or Brock may have used the clomiphene, absent a banned substance, et cetera, may have used the clomiphene not connected to any other usage. So that is the only scenario, but it is by far the rarest of the three scenarios.
And this Jones story has been unpacked a little bit. The Jones camp seems adamant that his failed test came from a tainted supplement, much like the Yoel Romero situation, who he, interestingly enough, is also a Malki Kawa client. Do you give much credence to their defense that Jones perhaps innocently took a tainted supplement?
You know, that's a real uphill climb. And the reason it is, first off, the tainted supplement defense is a very tough defense to make out at any point. You have to be able to go find, or USADA has to be able to go find, the same lot. So every batch that's made of a product has like a lot number on it. It means it was all manufactured together. And technically, for that defense to be successful, you have to get another bottle from that lot number, test it, and find the banned substance in it, and the banned substance can't be on the label, because if it was on the label, because keep in mind, not all banned substances are illegal. There are substances that are banned for competition that are perfectly legal. They're not underground anabolic steroids or anything like that. They're just banned substances. So what you're saying with a tainted supplement defense is there was something in that bottle that is not on the bottle, so I had no way of knowing that I was taking something that was banned because it's not marked on the label. In order to make out that defense, let's assume for a moment that they could get the lot and everything else. What makes it so unlikely to me that John will be able to successfully maintain that defense is that he didn't just fail for one banned substance, he failed for two. So now you're going to have to prove that you took supplements that had two different banned substances in them, both of which are drugs. So we're not even talking about a banned substance that is readily available over the counter. We're talking about a banned substance that's a prescription drug. Is it possible? it's possible. Is it likely? To me, it's 1,000 to 1. Because I went back and I found a history of tainted supplements that outlined 850 different tainted supplements. There were about 8 to 10 that were in the what's called aromatase inhibitor category. So if that's all he failed for, you could argue, hey, you know, there was something in those that was defined as an aromatase inhibitor, which kind of works the same as an estrogen blocker. It's a little different, but it's a distinction without a difference for our purposes. I couldn't find one supplement ever that had clomiphene in it or Clomid in it that was tainted with that drug. Not one. I couldn't find one. So if he's able to find a supplement that actually has clomiphene in it, props to him, because it would be, doesn't mean it's never happened, but I could not find a single documented case of a dietary supplement that actually contained clomiphene or Clomid. So that's, to me, it'd be like hitting the lottery for John if he was able to do that. But even if he does do that, well, I'm sure Brock Lesnar would be interested, because I'm sure he'd say he took the same thing. He also has to prove the aromatase inhibitor. So he basically has to strike lightning twice. That's going to be really difficult.
I wanted to also ask you about the Chad Mendes situation. It seems like the guy legitimately suffers from plaque psoriasis, a skin condition on his legs. And there are, you know, years-old pictures of him from weigh-ins and fights showing the rashes. So it seems legit. So on surface level, this seems wildly unfair to Chad. Do we need USADA to get more mechanisms in place to protect guys like him who need to take a banned substance to treat a pre-existing medical condition? Or are you not as sympathetic to his defense? What's your take on all this Chad Mendes stuff?
A couple of things. I don't think we need mechanisms because they're already there. You can still apply for a therapeutic use exemption for a banned substance if you have a medically necessary reason to use that substance, right? I mean, you know, again, not all banned substances are, you know, high-end performance-enhancing drugs. Some are more basic things that you just may need because of a medical issue. There's ADD, you know, like attention deficit disorder drugs that are banned substances. So in his case, if he was using this for his psoriasis, that's a perfect scenario where he could go to them in advance and say, I have this medical condition, which he apparently does have. As you say, you go back and look at pictures on his elbows as well. There's images out there of him with the psoriasis. And I know I had a friend who had psoriasis. It's highly annoying, itchy all the time, painful. So I get that you would want to take whatever you could to help that condition. The problem is that if you're using it for that medical purpose, then you have to go make sure that it doesn't have anything in it that's banned. And if it does have something in it that's banned, then you have to get approval before you can use it. Otherwise, you can pop and fail, like what happened to him. The interesting thing is that when I had a source who told me that that's what he failed for, and the source told me that it was a cream and that he did not know that this GHRP6 was in the cream, which I at first thought was a bunch of BS, because we have strict labeling laws. To not have it on the label is a stretch. And then I did some searches and actually found a company in Australia that was selling as a cosmetic base for products a plain white tube with nothing on it, and then in the ingredients listed on the box and on the website, it said GHRP6. So I was shocked. The unfortunate thing for Chad is that GHRP6, and this is one of the reasons I rarely buy into the defenses of athletes. You know, a lot of it is dog ate my homework stuff. In his case, GHRP6 is so ineffective as a performance-enhancing drug by itself. The reason it's on the ban list is because to stimulate growth hormone production and get similar benefits to human growth hormone but not take human growth hormone, you would combine GHRP6 with other peptides, and it would ultimately give you that effect. But he didn't test positive for anything else. So either there were other things they didn't catch, or he really took this either not knowing that it was in there or just using it for his psoriasis, and unfortunately it is on the ban list, and it would have done virtually nothing for him from a performance enhancement standpoint, and he's out for 2 years. I mean, if you're going to try to boost performance and you're going to risk failing a test, GHRP6 is among the lowest things on the ladder that you would use.
All right, last question for you. I've got to ask a non-PED question just to show everyone you're not a one-trick pony. Tyron Woodley, your new welterweight champion, when it was all said and done, he said he wanted the money fight against Nick Diaz instead of taking on the guy in Stephen Thompson, who most would probably say is the rightful number one challenger. We saw something very similar last month when Eddie Alvarez voiced his desire to fight Conor McGregor instead of Tony Ferguson or Khabib Nurmagomedov. Do you have any problem with guys going after the big payday instead of taking on the deserving next in line?
I do, and thanks for letting me show something beyond PEDs and USADA issues and calling them out for their foolishness. But yeah, and I'll throw one more on the list. How about Michael Bisping fighting Dan Henderson, who's I think ranked 10th? Look, the rankings are worthless. We understand that. The rankings are a joke. I mean, I think Bloody Elbow or Cage Potato, one of the two, did an article like a year and a half ago or a year ago with like dissecting the rankings, and there were media members who were ranking people in the wrong divisions, ranking them in divisions that they hadn't had a fight in a year and a half, all sorts of stuff. So the rankings are a joke, and the UFC knows they're a joke, and Dana White said when they did the rankings that he wasn't going to pay any attention to them to make fights, that he was still going to make the fights the fans wanted to see, etc. So the rankings mean nothing. However, accomplishment and performance, regardless of where a media ranks you, should mean a lot, if not almost everything. And yeah, I guess Nick Diaz is a money fight for Tyron Woodley more than Stephen Thompson, certainly a less risky fight, but Nick Diaz hasn't won a fight in the UFC since 2011. 5 years. 5 years. And that was BJ Penn fighting at 170 pounds where he absolutely never belonged. He was a legend at 155, and aside from the old days when he fought at 170, before, I would argue, modern MMA made the divisions much more competitive and you couldn't fight. He fought Lyoto Machida at 205 at one point. That could never happen now. That's because the sport was so immature that if you were really good, you could offset some of that weight difference. These days, that's much harder to do. That's his last win for Nick. And, you know, Eddie, I understand everybody wants McGregor, especially after the loss. He looks like easy prey in certain respects. Nate, we'll see if he can handle him a second time. But your history in your division should mean something. And when fighters are now getting accustomed to just calling out fights that they think are going to be the money fights, I understand that they're here to make money. But at the end of the day, it's still supposed to be a sport, and it's still supposed to have some level of what I would call competitive and performance integrity. And if fighters just continue to get the message that he who or she who yells the loudest, insults the most, has the most Twitter followers, is going to get the biggest money fights, I don't think that's the message from a sports standpoint that you want to send. I understand there's an entertainment element, There is. But at the end of the day, you have to make a decision as a promotion whether you're a sport first or you're entertainment first. And it doesn't mean you can't be both sport and entertaining, but what drives your core decisions? Is it performance or Twitter followers? But I guess with CM Punk, a.k.a. Phil Brooks, his real name, fighting in the UFC, having more self-confessed concussions than seconds of actual fight time, I guess Twitter followers is the answer.
Excellently said. His podcast is on the short list of MMA podcasts I recommend to people and can be found online at prommaradio.com. He can be found on Twitter at Larry Pepe, all one word, no underscores. Any other plugs you'd like to get in before we let you go?
Yeah, last thing, Jake, is we are also the voice for the U.S. military, which I'm very proud of, on American Forces Network. The show goes into 170 countries and 150 ships at sea. So if anybody is serving, thank you for your service. Or if you know someone who is serving and they like MMA, you can catch us on American Forces Network. The Voice is the channel. It's the biggest channel that they have. And we are on Saturdays at 5 Pacific.
We appreciate your time and hope to chat with you again down the road sometime. Thanks again, Larry.
Sounds good to me, Jake. Thanks for having me on.
And there he goes. Had a nice chat. Once again, his podcast is prommaradio.com, and he can be found on Twitter at Larry Pepe. I guess all that leaves for us is UFC Fight Night, Rodriguez versus Caceres. You ready to get to that one, Pat?
Oh, hell yeah, bro.
Oh, hell yeah. And I can't say this for a lot of cards, but one of the fights I'm most pumped for is on the UFC Fight Pass prelims, Cub Swanson and Tatsuya Kawajiri, both fighting in the second fight of a 12-fight card that is pretty shallow. I don't know what this is just a play to... get more people logged up on Fight Pass. That's really the only thing I can think of, because both of these guys are very talented fighters. You got fights between Teruto Ishihara, one of my favorite fighters, famous for I'll bring up the clip in a second, but famous for a recent post fight interview with Rogan. David Tamer versus Jason Novelli, Victor Pesta versus Marcin Tybura, and Court McGee taking on Dominique Steele. And let me find that post fight interview with Rogan. But what stands out to you on these prelims here?
Well, as you mentioned, this is another card, kind of like UFC 201. Actually, you know what? As I look at it, the name recognition factor not so high on this card overall. Certainly, Cub Swanson versus Tatsuya Kawajiri, that is arguably the fight with the two biggest names on the card, and it is the featured fight on the UFC Fight Pass network. And you are correct, Jake. I actually saw an interview with a UFC executive who was in charge of Fight Pass, and he was like, oh, the UFC featured prelim, that was my idea. That's how you justify Fight Pass. And really all you do is just split up these cards, make stupid bout orders. This fight should not be the second fight on the card. This is just some bum ass CEO trying to justify his job. When
I think
really,
Cub
I think,
smashes him too. By the way, I didn't get my pick. I think this is a very one-sided fight.
Yeah, I think I would agree with you on that one. Cub traditionally has had problems with the wrestlers, but after how he was able to handle Hakran Diaz and get a W and get back on the winning side of things, Hakran Diaz, a big, strong Brazilian, definitely some good grappling credentials. With Cub's boxing and what he was able to do against Hakran Diaz, I certainly think he'll be able to navigate Tatsuya Kawajiri in this one. Man, the Fox Sports 1 preliminary card really not familiar with anybody except for Court McGee and Dominique Steele. Court McGee, he's been one of my favorites. Great story. One of my favorite fighters off of The Ultimate Fighter, even though his was a later season. I forget which one his was. 7, 8, 9, 10, something around there. But Court McGee, great story. I'm always rooting for that guy. He's overcome a lot. Coming off a loss to Santiago Ponzinibbio. Dominique Steele, a good fighter in his own right, exciting fighter. He's certainly a fairly well-seasoned vet, so that should be a good scrap as well. And I'm definitely looking forward to this card. You know, we kind of talked about it a little bit early, so I mentioned with the UFC 201. Sometimes the ones that don't have the biggest name value, sometimes those are the ones that bring the biggest action, so hopefully we'll have a case of that this coming Saturday.
You do actually make a really good point. I feel like almost with no fail, every card we take a dump on may not have the most star power, which, I mean, it's hard to do after you have that UFC 200 weekend that I'm sure exhausted a big part of the roster. You have UFC 202 and 201 on either side of this. There still should be some fun fights. Going into the main card, we have Marina Moroes, Trevor Smith, Santiago Ponzinibbio. He's taking on Zach Cummings. Chris Camozzi making an appearance against Talis Laetes, which I'm calling an upset special there. I think Chris gets it done. Dennis Bermudez, a big favorite against Honey Jason. We'll save the main event for its own breakdown, but what stands out to you on the main card? A lot of close fights as far as Vegas sees it, you know, nothing too skewed. Aside from the Cub fight, I think the biggest favorite on this entire card is just like a -255 or -325 and -255, which those aren't that crazy odds. You know, every fight is winnable both ways, which should make for an entertaining card.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point, Jake. That typically does, especially with Vegas even seeing it so close. Main card, that's definitely where we see a little bit more in the way of name recognition. Marina Moroes, I'm a little more familiar with her, not so much Danielle Taylor. But those women's strawweights, I love seeing them fight. Trevor Smith versus Joe Gigliotti. If my Italian is correct, not familiar with Mr. Gigliotti, but Trevor Hot Sauce Smith, he's a good fighter. I enjoy seeing his brand of action. And Santiago Ponzinibbio versus Zach Cummings, definitely like that fight. Both guys have great striking styles. Zach Cummings, how did he get to 170 pounds? He is a huge 170 pounder, and yeah, that's going to be a fantastic scrap, really. Couple good strikers there. Laetes versus Camozzi. I was kind of surprised at this one just because Laetes is coming off he's on a 2-fight losing streak, whereas Chris Camozzi is on a 3-fight winning streak. So I'm certainly with you in that one in picking the upset. I think Camozzi, he's riding that momentum. Man, he's been doing good for himself lately. Always like Chris Camozzi, another Ultimate Fighter competitor I've enjoyed watching over the years. Going to the featherweight fight, also Dennis Bermudez versus Honey Jason. They've been putting on entertaining fights throughout their UFC tenure as well, coming from their tough days. And man, that's an interesting one to call. But man, Honey's got some power. Dennis has some good strikes. He's really, really looks like he's just been putting more tools in the toolbox there. Tough one to call, but man, I think I'm going to have to go with Bermudez. Yeah, tough one, man. Yeah, I think Bermudez will be my choice for the co-main there.
And on the main event, we got Alex Caceres taking on Yair Rodriguez. I think this is Yair's fight all day. Another one of these guys. He's training, I guess, do you know what Camby's training? I thought he was training with Jackson's, but this says Ragnarok MMA. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I thought he was with Jackson as well. Not 100%.
The guy has just looked so... I mean, he throws these crazy strikes, but at the same time, looks so calm in there, composed. Alex Caceres, I feel like, only wins fights when he has the speed advantage and can kind of dance around and clown opponents. Yair hasn't lost since joining the UFC, looking for his fifth UFC victory. I'm Googling now using the power of Google. I'm 99% sure he trains with Jackson's. Yeah, he does. This is a guy with a really great natural skill set, calm in there. He's training with the best trainers in the world. I think, he could be a future world champ. You know, he's just 23. And I think he picks up a finish victory here. I don't know how he finishes it, but I'll go ahead and say he gets the finish.
I like that prediction, Jake. Very bold as always. Yeah, you know what? Yair certainly seems like a bright prospect. As you mentioned, just 23. He is with Jackson Winklejohn MMA. And he seems to have only just improved since coming into the UFC. I mean, he is 4-0 now, three decisions in a row. Just got a flying head kick knockout. That was a thing of beauty over Andre Feely, UFC 197. So went from decision, all fun fights. Yair definitely brings the fight, great style. I mean, obviously, when you win a fight with a flying head kick knockout, Jesus Christ, that was just insane. Obviously, you're going for the gusto when you're fighting, if that's how you're finishing shit. But he seems to just be improving. He's young, lot of talent. Alex Caceres really has always just seemed more like a gatekeeper to me. He did a great job in defeating Cole Miller. I thought Cole Miller would have an advantage over him in that fight. I thought Cole Miller would probably beat him everywhere the fight went. And Caceres proved me wrong and was able to score a unanimous decision victory there. And, hey, he's 2-0 since going back to 145 pounds after a pretty good stint at bantamweight. He was down there for, gosh, I want to say, 3, maybe almost 4 years there, but just could not crack the top 10 at bantamweight. Man, it's going to be tough for him to do the same at featherweight. Goodness gracious, I'm almost, man, I feel like I'm almost smelling an upset now. The more that I'm looking at this one. But you know what? I can't go against the Jackson Winklejohn prospect. I got to go with our boy Yair. I feel like he's just a little bit slicker than Caceres. Maybe not so much on the ground, certainly on the feet. But you know, Caceres, he's a decent mixed martial artist himself. Just about everywhere it goes. You know, the more I think about it, his striking isn't so bad. He's got some good submissions, was able to get a submission over Sergio Pettis in a fight he was losing. Granted, a guy who should have been fighting at featherweight against a guy who should have been fighting at flyweight, but that's neither here nor there. Took out an excellent striker there with his submissions. Man, can't sleep on Caceres. Definitely don't want to sleep on him, but I'm going with the Vegas odds favorite in old Pantera, Yair Rodriguez.
That's a good rule of thumb. When in doubt, go with the Jackson's fighter. I believe that does it for us. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at The MMA Podcast. Visit TheMMAPodcast.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. Pat, you got anything for us?
Jake, you know, I was playing so hard. They thought I'd ball for Nova Scotia. It's a beautiful situation over here. a beautiful time was had by all. I know the fans and the listeners enjoyed it, Jake. Of course they do. They always do. We love them so much, and we put the love into the show for the fans of the MMA podcast and the MMA and UFC in general. God bless them. God bless you, Jakey, doing the Lord's work. Always a pleasure, sir.
Playing so hard, they figured out ball from Montreal. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week to break down the card, talk the weekend MMA. You know what it is, people. We'll see you next week. We gone.
Playing so hard, they figured out.
They used to hate me, but look who's laughing now. Run up on my camp, get dropped like Manny Pacquiao. Cooler than day weather, Versace berry sweater. Or is it cause I talk more shit than Judge Judy and Floyd Mayweather?
Watch me now, burn up in the wind. Now I'm in Toronto in the Tropicana Benz. Winnipeg again, got more ice than Edmonton. Now I'm in Vancouver on some Grizzly Adam Rim.
Now I'm all the way in South America, in the Panda Express, Porsche Panamera. Rip. I done blazed a few trails in Portland, Oregon. Swish. Now I'm in Canada, more than Tim Horton.